Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has over 6 years of law enforcement analysis experience in three different states. She volunteers for the election committee and mentoring committee with the IACA. She's currently a data analyst with the Division of Youth Services with the state of Colorado. And she's also a writer to a very awesome podcast. Today, we interview our very own Mindy Yoon. Mindy, how are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yes, I know you so well that I could have gone on for days giving you the introduction, but it's great to have you on the show, and I hope that it wasn't too boring writing up your own questions.
No, it was fun. It's just interesting being on the other side now. I've always been in the background, so this is going to be interesting.
Yes. So we'll have to do maybe a post-meeting or something like that. Just so you let me know what it feels like to be a guest under the heat lamp, so to speak, of the show. There's a lot, obviously, I want to get into. You grow up in California. You go to Cal State Fullerton. How did you discover law enforcement analysis?
So I actually didn't find out about crime analysis until my senior year of college. I knew I wanted to do something with criminal justice. I just didn't know what. I was lucky that Cal State Fullerton had extended education like certificate programs. So I was just going through the list of things that they have. I actually got a certificate in private investigations first because it was just there and it sounded cool. Like I didn't know what else to do. And then I saw crime analysis and same train of thought. I was like, well, I don't know what I want to do. So I'll just take these classes, see what they're about. And I took it and it really resonated with me. I really liked doing the work. I really liked doing the analytical behind the scene work. So I took it. I actually did not finish it because I couldn't afford it. It was supposed to be like a 1 year program, but it took me like about 3 years to complete because I had to pay for it myself. So it took some time, but I was lucky because I was able to take enough of the classes that I got an internship with the Irvine Police Department for their crime analysis unit. I was in the class, I interned, and it was really eye-opening seeing how it actually worked in reality, how the analysts there at Irvine did their work. So I fell into it, I guess. Not so much randomly, but it was one of those things that I just discovered. So I think I was very fortunate to be where I was.
So the certificate programs at Cal State Fullerton, mm-hmm. are those like minors, or what makes them different?
So they're separate certificate programs. So I don't get college credit for them. I get certificate points for them. So they're completely different. So whether I got their certificate or not, like I couldn't, I guess, double dip for credits. So I couldn't claim it as a minor. It wasn't a major. It wasn't like a specialization that you can claim with your degree. It was something offered by the school, but it was completely separate. Okay. In terms of like credits for graduating.
And what did the PI certification do for you in terms of your analyst career?
Not really much because I didn't go the PI route, but I personally, I think it just helped me have a different lens in the world. I mean, I don't know if this is embarrassing to say, but I actually changed my major like 5 times. During my undergrad year, because I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I came in as an undeclared, and then I'm like, maybe I want to do accounting. Maybe I want to go to medical. Maybe, you know, like you're 17, 18, just entering the world. You don't know what to do with the rest of your adult life. But all those times trying out things, I really do think it helped me become more well-rounded. And I feel like it gave me a different approach when looking at the data and just having this unique lens coming. It wasn't like I was in criminal justice and that was it kind of thing, if that makes sense.
So your internship with Irvine Police Department, what tasks did you do for them?
So I actually never interned. I think the universe was just really nice to me. I applied as an intern, but they had a job opening at the same time. So even though I applied to be an intern, I interviewed again for the public safety assistant position. I actually got hired as a part-timer. Yes. But most of my work was data entry, and they taught me how to do a lot of entry-level stuff, which makes sense. So data entry, I made bulletins every now and then. I help with some case support. I help with some mapping. So it was a lot of entry-level stuff. And looking back, I remember as being early 20s, not understanding, like, why are they making me do so much data entry? Like, this is so boring. Like, what is the point of this? But looking back now, I like really appreciated it. Like, you know, when you're there at the time, you think, oh, I'm getting all the grunt work, or I'm the new girl, they're hazing me kind of thing. But really looking back, I talked to my former supervisor, Darcy. Whenever I get a chance, I always thank her, like, thank you for having me do all this. I learned so much. Rebecca, who was the other crime analyst at the time, they're still all there.
Do you know their last name?
Yes, sorry. Darcy got married, I believe, last year or the year before. So I knew her as Darcy Purvis, but now she goes by Darcy Jones. And Rebecca's last name is Woolsey.
Is what?
Woolsey. I'll okay. spell it for you in the notes.
That's okay.
Yeah. I remember when Rebecca used to proofread my work, and she would always be very particular about like where the periods goes and where the comma goes. And I would always get frustrated. Like, I wouldn't express it, but in my head, I'm like, Rebecca, you know what I'm trying to say. Like, all the notes are there. Like, why are you being so particular about a period or a comma? Like, what is the big deal? Like, I just do not understand benefit and value of data entry. Now that I'm where I am now and going through the years and learning how to use formulas in Excel, my new job, I'm learning about coding and automation. And commas are so important. Spaces are so important because, like, you as the human, when you're doing your data entry, like, you know what you're trying to say, whether there's a comma or not a comma. But when you're trying to put it in a code and a formula, like, the computer detects something with a comma and something without a comma as unique entities, and they count them separately. So it was one of those things where at the time I did not appreciate it. I'm like, they're just making me do all the grunt work. But now that I'm more experienced, I see the value of data entry. I see the value of doing things the quote unquote hard way, or the boring way, or the basic way, the manual way, and how it really built a very strong foundation to do all the fun analytical stuff that I do now.
So you got hired as a public safety assistant. What does a public safety assistant do?
Yeah, so a public safety assistant is the general term that the department used for a generalist. I don't want to say like a miscellaneous category, but basically a PSA, they can be assigned to records, they can be assigned to the front desk. I happen to be assigned to the crime analysis unit, so lucked out on that one because it was what I end up doing with my career. So I did the basic crime analysis tasks. I did data entry. I made bulletins, I made maps, I helped with case investigations. I wasn't at the level where I am now, obviously, since I just started my career. I was at kind of like an intern entry level, but I was able to shadow my colleagues there. So Darcy is very good with administrative analysis and crystal reports. So I was able to stare over her shoulder every now and then and basically ask her, like, how do you do this? Rebecca is really good with Microsoft Access, Microsoft Excel. So she taught me a lot of the foundational stuff that I know now. And Lori Villardi is a whiz in ArcGIS and geographic profiling. So I had a chance to, again, shadow and observe her work. So it was kind of like a paid internship almost. So I really appreciated the opportunity and the time I spent there.
You make the trek from California to Vermont. That is quite a leap.
So as I said earlier, the analysts that I started my career with, Darcy, Rebecca, and Lori, they're still at Irvine Police Department, and all the other analysts that I knew then, all those analysts in Southern California, I believe they're still in their roles today. So once someone gets a job as an analyst or in government in general, like they just stay there. It's a good gig, but it's hard for someone who's new and coming in because, again, I was with Irvine as a part-timer for 2 years, and Rebecca's only, I think, a year or two older than me. So by the time she retires, I would be already retired as well. So I was still in my early 20s. I wasn't married. I didn't own a house. I didn't have children. So I was thinking, like, I really have, you know, besides my whole life, you know, my friends, family, like it was a lot to give up, but I didn't have anything holding me back. So I was like, I'll just throw my resume across the country, see what sticks. I was going through government jobs because it keeps a history of all the places that you apply to. And I was looking at one of the applicants that I applied to, and I was wishful thinking because 2 years as a part-timer and I applied for like a senior position out in like Virginia or something. I don't know why I thought I would even qualify.
But remember what Sean Bear said during the hiring guide, you just never know, right? Because you never know what people really want or if you're going to be a good fit or what experience you would get from just going through the process, even if you don't get it.
Yeah, definitely. But for that one, they never got back to me. I just thought it was funny looking back because I am hesitant now after over 6 years. I'm like, am I senior level yet? I'm not sure. But back then I was like, yeah, I got 2 years part-time. Yeah, I can do this. Anyways, one of my application was to the Vermont Fusion Center, or I think officially they're called Vermont Intelligence Center. So I sent my resume there. I went through the hiring process. They interviewed me and I got the position. I was thinking, I've never left the California bubble, so why not go as far as I can across the country, see where it goes? And it goes back to what I said earlier of like, you know, whatever experience, however random it feels, like it just makes you more well-rounded. It gives you this experience. It gives you this new lens in the world. I only lasted a year because it was really cold. I mean, coming from Southern California, going to like the Northeast. I remember my first winter there, the snow was over, oh my gosh, it was like 6-7 feet. Like I was unable to leave my apartment. I don't want to say traumatic, but it was like, okay, maybe this isn't for me. So obviously now I'm in Colorado, which is kind of like the best of both worlds. Like I do get snow, but it's not like 7 feet over your head snow.
So besides the weather, there had to be additional cultural experiences or cultural differences.
As you know, I am Asian. California itself is pretty diverse. There's a bunch of different races, cultures, ethnicities there. When I went to Vermont, it wasn't voided of minorities, but it was very different.
Not as diverse.
Yeah. I think SNL actually did a skit about Vermont regarding their diversity, but regarding law enforcement, crime analysis, and civilian, it was very different. I felt like I was very spoiled at Irvine, not only because I had Darcy, Rebecca, and Lori always looking out for me because I was the new girl, I was the partner, and they always looked out for me, and I always felt spoiled because they always almost protected me. And any mistake that I made, like Rebecca always knew, like, okay, this is what you did. This is how you broke the database. I'll fix it. And I'm like, thanks, Rebecca. I'm so sorry. I keep breaking stuff. Anytime I made a mistake, they always caught it. So when I was in Vermont, like, I didn't have any of those safety nets anymore. So I really had to learn to fend for myself. But because civilian analysts wasn't as progressive in Vermont as it was in Southern California, my mindset wasn't prepared for it. But I think that's why I was so fortunate to be a part of the pilot program for the mentoring committee mentioned at the beginning. Yes, with the IACA. And I had such a good experience with it, which is why I wanted to volunteer for it once I got the opportunity. So I was part of the pilot program when the IACA mentoring program rolled out, and I was paired with Tony Berger, whom you had on the show, who really helped me through my time at Vermont, because again, I left everything I knew, like friends, family, you know, my safety net was Irvine, to go to this new place where I didn't know anybody, know anything. And crime analysis wasn't as progressive there. So especially being young female, and I was inexperienced too, like I had so many things against me. And here I am wanting to take on the world kind of thing. So one thing that I remember sticking out that was confusing for me was that as an analyst, I didn't have access to the back end of the data. I didn't have access to the back end of the RMS. Basically, things that were already in place when I was at Irvine, and that was just all I knew, that you have an access database or crystal reports or whatever, and it connects to the back end of your RMS, do your analysis, you pull your report. So that's all I knew at the time. So I was confused, like, oh, it's not here. Like, oh, how exciting. I get to kind of learn how to make it from scratch. Because again, it was already established at Irvine and I just had to maintain it. This is an opportunity for me to build it from scratch. But what I ran into was I wasn't allowed to have access to the data. And I was just confused. I was like, what do you mean? I'm your analyst. Like, I'm your statistician. Like, I should have access. Like, and to me, I'm like early 20s, not being as experienced as I am. Like, I don't understand. Like, isn't this common sense? Your analyst should have access to the data. I remember, just for lack of better words, I don't want to go too much into it, but I was reprimanded for asking. And I remember feeling so distraught. I was crying. You know, I talked to Tony. Am I doing something wrong? Do I just suck at my job? Did I just leave everything and everyone I knew behind to pursue this career that I'm apparently like trash at? And they made me feel so bad. I was like, am I doing something wrong? Not that people at Vermont were like always shouting and yelling at me or anything like that, but I just felt so confused. And I remember Tony telling me to think of it as like a rite of passage. Once you get into this kind of conflict with IT or whoever not giving you access to the data, it's a rite of passage. Like, other analysts go through this. This is not a unique problem. Like, it's pretty common. And after that moment, I was like, okay, well, if this is how it's going to be, well, I have access to other things. I'm going to find a way to get the data the approved way and still be able to do my job. And it was really strengthening all of my fundamentals, because I was trying so hard to learn Access. I was trying so hard to learn Excel, and without having access to the data, okay, well, how can I do this on my own? And while the experience was hard, I really felt it did help me grow to who I am today, whether it be my technical skills or my mental and emotional resilience. So I am thankful for the experience.
What a perfect mentor for you, though. A sworn officer with decades of experience working in fusion centers, history of teaching Excel and Access. Really, you couldn't have asked for a better mentor in your situation.
Yeah, it started that I just need help with Access, because again, I didn't have background in it. I essentially thought like, oh, maybe he'll just be like a tutor for me. But then that one thing happened and I basically need a shoulder to cry on, and he was there for me. And yeah, he really helped me grow. I mean, I'm better with Access, but I'm also, I think, a better person as well.
Yeah. So for those that might not be aware, what is the analyst's role at a fusion center?
I think it varies per state. When I was over in Vermont, I did risk assessments, I did intelligence reports, things that you expect at the state level. But because Vermont didn't have a lot of crime analysts throughout the state, the local police departments also called on our fusion center to help with case support. So I also did tactical analysis, which was weird to me because my role was criminal intelligence analyst. So I was thinking I would do more research-based stuff, but it made sense at the time. And honestly, it was more of my comfort zone too, because that's what I was familiar with when I was at Irvine, of doing tactical and case support stuff. Here in Colorado, I don't interact with the Fusion Center as much, but I do see that they do more research-based, more intelligence-based. I don't know how much case supports they actually do, because there are a lot more analysts here. Denver PD has a lot of analysts. Aurora PD has a lot of analysts. Lakewood has two. most of the smaller agencies like Wheat Ridge only have one, but basically every PD has their own analyst. And if they don't, they usually go to the nearest PD or the nearest county analyst for assistance. So I don't know what is standard, I guess. Like, I feel like fusion centers, they were created post 9/11 for intelligence and info sharing, be this hub for information, that information goes in and information goes out. So I think all fusion centers have that core mission, but I feel like their daily tasks differ depending on where they're at.
Yeah, I think most do some sort of threat assessment. So did you do any threat assessments there at Vermont?
I did. But it's also Vermont, we're a pretty small state. I mean, you have New York, which has a bigger population next to us. I did do some for like any large gatherings. We did have some, was it the Olympics? Some snow sport competition. So we would do assessments for those, any marathons, any big events or concerts I did for those. I didn't do terrorism level stuff because, again, it's Vermont, the threat's pretty low. But I guess...
I'm laughing right now because I can just imagine somebody from Vermont or that area cringing when you say some snow sport.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry.
It's okay, but I can just imagine them. Some snow sport, right? But go on, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Skiing, snowboarding, if it makes them feel better, I don't know. I'm not sporty, so I guess like surfing competitions, like beach sports, like that's probably what I would say if I was in California too. Like now that I'm in Colorado where skiing's huge too, I'm always like winter sports. I don't know. So nothing personal. Yeah, so another assessment that I did that I thought was so fun and so cute was when Pokemon Go first started, like when it first launched, I was in Vermont and I was so excited because Pokemon was my childhood. It was probably a lot of people's childhood who were born in the 90s. So I was so excited when I saw it and I actually did a risk assessment on it. It started out as a joke. I was like, this is so cute. I'm going to do this. It's going to be funny. But as I was doing more research into it, I was like, oh, there is something here because I'm thinking about research regarding texting and driving, distracted driving, and just thinking about how people are obsessed with being on their phones, like in that same boat, like staring at my phone all the time. So I was thinking like, if people are trying to catch Pokemon and they're just on their phone, like they can legit walk into traffic and get run over, you know, at least cause like a traffic jam. And then I was also thinking about, it's kind of dark, but like all the people who fell off the side of the cliff at the Grand Canyon, like trying to take a selfie, that could happen. What if you're trying to catch a Pokemon that's on the side of a cliff and without thinking you walk off? So there were some actual, like, it sounds funny, but there's like some actual concerns. So I was putting together a risk assessment of like, here are some things that we need to be aware of. People might be walking into people's backyards trying to catch a Pokemon. People might be walking into traffic. So again, it started out as something funny. It started out as a joke, but as I delved further into it, it got pretty serious. And I presented it to my supervisor for approval. And again, I preface it. I know it sounds weird. They essentially laughed it off. And I was like, haha, yeah, it's funny, but no, but really it's serious. And they just dismiss it. They're like, are you serious? Like, why would this can't be true? Like, why would anybody do this? But it's serious. But anyways, so they dismissed it. It didn't go through. I want to say it was either a week or two afterwards that the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, also put out their own risk assessment pertaining to Pokemon Go. That was essentially what I written a week or two before. And while I felt vindicated, like, see, like, I know it sounded like a joke, but it was serious. Like, we have to keep up with modern times. Like, just because something sounds ridiculous, think about like the Tide Pod challenge. Like, we as adults, we're like, that's stupid. Why would anybody do that? But think how viral that went. And then with the COVID challenge, like people licking public toilets, trying to get, like, it's baffling. Like, why would people do this? Like, it's so stupid. But that's just the unfortunate reality that we lived in. And as, I don't know, as a millennial, as a young person, as someone who's on TikTok, I don't know, like, I'm just aware of those things. So it was very disheartening
It's a tough situation, especially when you're young, especially when you're inexperienced. I think back to talking with Joe Ryan and the idea of how important sales is to the analytical position. And this is a great example of selling the idea, especially with so much pushback. I don't blame you. I would have been in that same situation too at that age. It is frustrating, but it had to feel so damn good to be vindicated by that Homeland Security report.
Yeah, it did. But I was just like, this is why you have a diverse group of people. You bring different things to the table. And no matter how, I guess, again, silly it sounds, like everyone can pitch in. Everyone brings a different perspective to the table and we should consider it. And to me, I was just like, this is risk assessments, like bringing in different ideas. Like, is it plausible? Is it possible that this will happen? It's just like, I don't know, but this is why we're doing our research. This is why we're doing our assessment. But
so you move on from Vermont and head to Colorado, Lakewood, Colorado. And this is when we get into your badge story, your career defining case or project. So talk briefly about your transition to Colorado and then how you got assigned your badge project.
Yeah. So I, same story as how I ended up in Vermont. I just threw my resume across the country and my resume happened to stuck in Colorado. I've been to Colorado like once when I was like, I don't know, 8 years old. But other than that, I don't really know anything about Colorado. I thankfully got hired with the Auto Theft Task Force with the Lakewood Police Department. And I got my first big I didn't know it was big at the time. I got my first case 4 months into the job. It was supposedly open and shut case. They recovered the vehicle. There's suspects there already, like give it to the new girl kind of thing, like let her practice. And I was really thankful. I was like, okay, cool. Like an easy case. I can practice what I've learned in the, you know, 4 months that I was there. I get to build a rapport with one of the detectives because each case has a lead detective and then like a assisting analyst. As we delve further into the case, it wasn't just the recovered vehicle and then the suspects. What we found in the vehicle were items to numerous residential burglaries. So we followed those residential burglaries. What happened was when we followed those residential burglaries, it led to more stolen vehicles. And when we followed those stolen vehicles, it led to more residential burglaries. And that pattern just kept growing and growing and growing until it was massive. I was unprepared for it, to say the least, because I haven't done much investigative support. Like I've done here and there. I've made bulletins. I've made math. I've used Excel. Like those, I guess, for lack of better words, basic crime analysis tasks I've been able to do. I haven't ever worked a huge investigation before. So I was super nervous. I didn't know what to do, if I'm doing it right. And the other analysts who were there with me were experienced, but also in a similar boat, because every case investigation you do, it's going to take on a character of its own. Like there's no one size fit all when it comes to an analyst role in an organized crime investigation.
So how many analysts were there at the time in Lakewood?
So Lakewood PD, the headquarters, had two, Levi Giroux and Danielle, at the time, Stone, who's Danielle Giroux now, whom you've interviewed, was there. That's where I met her, at Lakewood. The task force itself, so I was the only Lakewood task force analyst at the Auto Theft Task Force. There was an Aurora analyst, the Adams County analyst, and State Patrol were there. So there was four of us.
Okay. So then how did all this case get resolved?
Overall, the case took, I want to say, a little under a year to fully bring it from beginning to close. But it took, oh my gosh, I think 2 years till we got everybody completely indicted and charged.
That's an awfully long open and shut case.
Yeah, I was like, how is this open and shut? But I did a plug for the show when I did my presentation. So I'm going to do a plug for my presentation on the show now. So a couple weeks ago, I did the presentation. So the case that we're talking about now, I did do a best practices how-to case study type of presentation to the Virginia Crime Analysis Network via IECA's platform. So it should have been recorded. And I don't know how long it takes, but it is recorded and it will go into the IECA library. I think, I hope. So if people are interested in my presentation, it is there. The reason why I like talking about that case and the reason why I think it's my badge story is I always felt like, when am I going to get my specialization? Like, everyone has a specialty. So I was like, what am I good at, kind of thing. So I keep spending, you know, all of my time, like, am I good at access? Because, you know, like, Tony trained me. Am I going to be good with SQL? Am I good? And it's just like, I want to be known for something. You know, so I was hoping that would be for this case, which I guess, you know, I developed some expertise in working in organized crime case. But what I found out was the task that I did for this case that ultimately got these people indicted, and each one of the main players, they got over 20 years incarcerated. Like, when we think property crimes, we think, oh, it's just an auto theft, it's just a property crime, like, you know, 1-2 years slap on the hand kind of thing. These people, because we charged them with organized crimes, they got over 2 decades each. Being new and being not knowing what you're doing, and you're like, oh, hey, a thing happened. I didn't even know like these numbers existed. Like, I thought you only get these numbers like if you capital murder or something. So the reason why I prefaced with all this other stuff was because I was saying like, oh, maybe now I'll learn a technical skill. But really, the main thing that I want to emphasize when you're working with an organized crime case is your organization skills and your time management skills, prioritizations, and communication. Those are the skills that were, I think, crucial to this case. I didn't use anything fancy. Like, I made bulletins using PowerPoint to make bulletins about my suspects. Like, hey, be on the lookout for these people. Like, they're involved in our investigations. If you have anything on them, please let us know. I organized the case in Excel, like just an Excel workbook, just an Excel sheet. And the Excel spreadsheet was basically like, hey, if you only have like 5 minutes to get familiar with this case that I've been working on for close to a year, like just refer to the spreadsheet. And it was just a quick overview of everything. Like, I had a column for the date, I had a column for the time, I had a column for the crime, I had the column for the address, vehicle, what they stole, who's the suspect. So I had those different columns. So it was a quick way for people to reference like, oh, okay, those are the people that are in the case that, or these are the force that I should be aware of. And the task force was multi-jurisdictional. So even though I was representing Lakewood, we were working a case that were beyond the borders of Lakewood. So it was important to keep these notes because it wasn't just going to be me staring at this. It might be a Wheat Ridge analyst. It might be a Thornton analyst. It might be a Denver analyst or detectives who may be looking at it. So I needed something that was a quick reference for people who haven't been staring at the case night and day like I was. I was lucky that we did have I2 for like link chart making, but I wasn't taught how to use I2. The only thing that my colleague Cassie taught me was, this is how you put in a picture and this is how you draw the lines. I was like, okay, like it's the equivalent of like if I did it in PowerPoint, which is what I've done before, or like just drawing on a whiteboard. So that's what I did with I2. Like, I didn't know how to use it. I just put pictures and drew lines.
On the job training.
Yeah, I was on the job training. Again, 4 months into the job. Like, I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing yet, but here I am kind of thing. And so I made link charts and timelines using that. I did PowerPoint presentations, again, just to try to explain it to people who haven't seen the case, like the prosecutor. He came in, he's like, what is this case about? And instead of throwing him, you know, 50 different case reports, it was just this quick presentation. So I was thinking like, oh, I'm going to go into this with like CSI and we're going to do, you know, looking at surveillance and like enhancing and doing all these fancy things like in the montage. What I ended up doing was just things that I normally would have done, like, you know, make a bulletin, put stuff in Excel. Doing the link chart was something unique to case investigation. So I did that. But at the end of it, I was like, I'm just doing what I've known. I'm just doing what I'm good at. I'm just doing like things that were in my fundamentals that I learned in, like, I guess, for lack of better words, like crime analysis 101 years.
I'm going to call you Matt Harris. I just did this. Well, yes, you're right. You just did this. But at the same time, your contributions to the investigation helped with the completion of the case. Us analysts have a tendency to downplay what we do because we, for some reason, we don't think it's maybe as important as some other parts of the investigation. But all that work that you did, keeping it organized, keeping the communication and documentation up to speed, doing all the research on all these folks and building the I-2 chart to help explain the complexity of the case. All that is important, and all that is a piece of the pie that needed to be included to take these guys down.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, I agree. That's what I was trying to get at as well, because like I was saying, like you, when you work these cases, when you are trying to get your badge story, I guess, I feel like there's like this intrinsic need to like, it has to be something big. I have to do something groundbreaking mm-hmm. and start a new trend. But really, it's the things that you do every day, the seemingly little things, they add up. And it's important, like you were saying, like these steps that we take are necessary to reach the ultimate goal.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting because I remember when we first started talking about the podcast, I think the question was, how did you change the world? People really took a step back with that question, thinking like, well, geez, I haven't changed the world. What I do is not that important. So that's where the badge story came to be. We replaced how did you change the world with the badge story. All right. Well, just to finish up, then was there a big arrest day, a takedown day of how this case came to completion?
I remember it was like something out of a movie. So the suspects fled across state bounds into Utah, and they were in this big chase on the highway and they crashed. And one of the suspects, he went out and some nice good Samaritan stopped to see if, hey, are you guys okay? The suspects carjacks that man. And I was like, dude, he's trying to be a nice person to check on you guys. So he carjacks this person, takes that nice person's car, drives off again, crashes again. So now this nice person's like, why did I stop? One of the officers that was, detectives that was helping out on the case, opened the door, went into the car with the suspects next to him and like just tased him. And it was just like this funny story. It was just like, why is this happening? Like, what are these guys thinking? And a second suspect was actually in Utah. He fled the scene of the crash. So he went into like the forest or jungle or you know, whatever they had, or the wilderness. I said jungle for Utah. I'm sorry, Utah. I don't know geography.
Utah is probably cringing on your some snow sports as well.
So as you can see, all I know is crime analysis and the pot. I don't know anything else about the world. The jungle of Utah wilderness. And we just didn't know where that second stuff. I think it was like in wintertime, so we thought he died. I'm sorry. Like you're just in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness. Where are you? We couldn't find you. The suspect is fine for anyone who's concerned. We found him. He decided to burglarize another residence and then we caught him. Like it was great. But that was kind of like the big takedown of the car chase, the car crash, and then carjacking another person in the middle of the crash or the chase, I'm sorry, and then crashing that car as well. But yeah, they were all eventually arrested. We organized the case with the Denver DA, presented it in front of a grand jury. They saw that we had enough to indict them. And it was just a funny story because I was looking at our case and it's not a convoluted story. It's not a convoluted case study. It's just a very big one.
So let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about your current position because you switched jobs this year. And I also want to talk about the internship program that you've established. This is Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Berger. I want to encourage each and every one of you to refuse to be offended. We're living in a world right now where everybody's talking and divided on different issues, and we are on social media, and what happens invariably is that somebody says or types something that irks us, makes us mad. And I just want to encourage you to not take offense to what other people say. Sniping back and forth at people serves no purpose.
This is Danielle Giroux, and I highly encourage you to lock up your valuables. Don't hide anything under a jacket or a blanket in your front passenger seat, behind your front passenger seat, or on your rear seat.
Welcome back. Talking with Mindy Yoon, our writer for the podcast. Now, Mindy, I want to talk a little bit about the internship program that you established. So talk a little bit about the keys to your internship program and do's and don'ts and anything else that you'd like to talk about.
Yeah. So I established the first internship program with the auto theft task force that I worked for. The reason why I wanted to do that was because there weren't many around. I think the state agencies, so the Fusion Center, the Colorado Bureau of Investigations, CBI, had an internship program. And I think a lot of police departments have like a volunteer program or a general internship program, but there wasn't something specific to crime analysis. I was like, why not? Let's try it kind of thing. And if I fail, well, I can be used as a bad example for future. Like, and don't do what Mindy did.
Don't be that analyst, right?
Don't be that analyst, basically. So I started by reaching out to IECA. I believe at the time we still have a listserv. So I was like, does anybody have any tips and tricks, any guides on how to do it from like the ground up? Because I don't think I knew if Lakewood PD, my home agency, had one. So I didn't really have a model to work off of. So I did my research. A lot of responses I got were mostly tips and tricks. These are things you should do. These are things you shouldn't do. Like, don't have them only do data entry. Have them do projects as well. Have them do bulletins. Have them do other stuff. Because as I said earlier, like at the time, you know, when you're new and you're like, why am I just getting data entry? Like, why am I getting all this grunt work? Like, I want to learn the cool stuff. I also said, like, data entry is important. It's the foundation of everything you're going to do moving forward. So it's good to have that foundation down first. But people were telling me, like, mix it up, have them do this, have them do that, have them go to the patrol briefings. Even if they don't have anything to share, it's good for them to be in front of the officers and being comfortable being in those meetings. So that's what I had my interns do, is go with me to the intelligence meetings that I go to. There are going to be some data entries, but I also gave them a project. So starting off, since we didn't have any foundations, I did research and just inquiries, Q&As with agencies that had internship programs. Eva Mazio and Ashley Hood in Anaheim PD helped me a lot because they have a very robust internship program. So short of stealing their idea and their program, I got a lot of feedback, and they were really nice. They were really helpful. And we had the same train of thought of like why we're doing this. We want to help people be comfortable, because I feel like there is a gap sometimes going from academia to the professional world. Like, there are just things that you learn in school that you're not really practicing in the professional world. So I'll go more into this later, because it has to do with like my job now. For example, like, I learned SPSS in school. I've never used it on the job before up until now with my new job. So there's been like a 6-year gap since I've used it. So like when I was a crime analyst at Irvine in Vermont and with Lakewood, I never had to use it. So it's like one of those things. But now I'm glad I learned it, because it affects my job now. But anyway, so I did research, just kind of get a foundation. Then I reached out to a school. I reached out to CU Denver, because they have a crime analysis certificate program. So I'm like, okay, you guys obviously have students that are interested in crime analysis. Because I thought that if I reached out to all schools that have a criminal justice program, it might be too broad, because they might be interested in other things. So I wanted a very specific cohort to work with. I established a relationship with the school and talked to their internship coordinator, like, hey, how do other people do this kind of thing? I want to make sure I do this right. Like, what have you seen in the past? Like, what works? And then I brought it to
the table with my commander. I didn't want to go to my commander first because I didn't want to be like, hey, I want an internship program. And he'll come back to me like, okay, you can do it, but how? And I would be stumped right there after the first question. So I did all my research first, build all my connections first, and then brought it to the table. Like, hey, I want to build a internship program. This is how Anaheim PD did it. This is what the school is expecting. This is what we can model off of, and this is how we can move forward.
You know, there's sales coming back, right?
You established
your product and you're selling the product. So keep on going.
And then after I got approval from my commander, we brought it to HR, like, hey, this is what we're doing. Like, what are all the HR stuff we have to do? Like, what do they have to fill out? What requirements, like privacy stuff? Like, obviously, you're going to go into the police department, you're going to have access to sensitive stuff. So do they need to do a polygraph? How does the background work? Do they need to do a drug test and all those stuff? So basically, it was almost like we were hiring a new person, but it was an unpaid internship. We then had to reach out to IT, like, hey, we're expecting a new body here. They're going to need an email. They're going to need a login to these different programs. They're going to need a computer. So we had to reach out to so many different entities. I remember thinking back before talking with Anaheim, it was a lot of these are things we should do after it was already established. But I was building from the ground up. So I was like, how do I do this? So it was a lot of connection building with the school, HR, IT, like nice networking with people and getting to know people for this new project. And then I try to involve my team as much as I could. So we came up with questions as a team. We interviewed as a team. The whole process was equal to hiring a new staff. And I think that's a good mentality to approach it, because even though this person is not experienced, but I thought it was important to treat them as like, hey, if this is a new member to our team, I want them to feel welcome. I don't want it to be stereotypical of like, hey, get me coffee kind of thing. I don't know. Like, I see it on the movies, you know, intern, get coffee, get my dry cleaning, you know. So that was an important mindset I thought that we established, was like, this intern is one of us. Like, we're going to teach them like they were our coworkers. So that's what we did. We taught them, here's what we do. Like, we showed them the things that we do, and anywhere that they can help, they will. But we also gave them like, hey, here's a project that we really need done. Like, by doing this project, you're going to practice every step of doing the work that an analyst did. And my first intern, I was so proud of like the lessons he learned, because he really got it. He did a statistical project for us. It was identifying motorcycle thefts and trailer thefts and truck thefts and auto thefts, like the auto theft task force, doing those statistical projects for us. He spent months cleaning the data because we wanted like a 5-year comparison. So he spent months cleaning the data, analyzing it, and putting it into a PowerPoint presentation that he presented to our unit, our command staff, and our director of our funding entity. And one of the things that he told me was that was a lot of work to look really simple, because his final product, it was a basic chart that he generated via Excel. It was bar graphs, it was pie graphs, there were tables showing numbers, and it was very simple. It looks simple. And he was saying like, you know, I spent months cleaning the data. I spent months analyzing it. I was telling him like, that's it. That's being an analyst. Like at the core of it is like, you're taking these big, complicated data sets and you're translating it into an easy to digest format. Like, we learn about all these cool, complicated tools, but ultimately we want to make it simple and easy to digest for our customers, because if they don't understand your data, they don't understand what they're looking at, they can't make actionable decisions off of it. Mm-hmm. So I was so proud of him to learn that lesson. I'm like, I know, right? It's like, there's so much work that goes into looking simple and looking easy.
The internship's so important. It really is a good way to get your foot in the door, to get you experience, and to get some practical knowledge behind the theory that you learn in school. I also think that interns physically being in the office is a leg up. People in the office will see this intern, get to know this intern, maybe even to work directly with this intern. If an opportunity for employment with that department comes around, then you have all these people that can speak for this intern. This intern worked late. This intern was a go-getter. This intern was great to work with. I'd like to continue to work with him or her. You know, that's going to be problematic now with COVID, right? But it's still important for that internship to be that bridge between schooling and your first job.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually had my second intern this year with the transition from being in the office and working from home. And it is difficult not being there and trying to share screens and explain things, especially to, again, you're an intern, you're entry level, like you don't have the full exposure to grasp everything that's being taught to you. So now that it's over Zoom, for example, it is harder. So my second intern, we ended with her working from home because, I mean, we weren't in the office. I'm not going to make my intern go into the office if I'm not there, make her be there by herself. So we did it by Zoom. My second intern was very good with communicating via email. If there's anything urgent, I call her. That's what we did. And it worked for us. It is weird, but I mean, it's our new normal now. I tried to keep to the schedule and like teach her to do this and do that, have a project. She presented her final project over Zoom.
So you have a general guide as a document for your internship program, correct?
Yes, I listed step by step on how to build an internship from the ground up. So if you have one, please reach out to me. We can share notes and maybe we can come up with a combined one that we can share with everybody else.
Sure. So that's leapodcasts@gmail.com. Email us. But we will also include a link to Mindy's guide in the show notes for this episode. All right. So let's move on. You changed jobs this year in the middle of COVID, leaving Lakewood PD and moving on to the state department. So talk about that transition and what you're doing now.
Yeah. So I am a data analyst now for the Department of Youth Services, which is on the side of corrections. So I'm out of law enforcement, but I'm still like in the criminal justice system.
Oh yeah,
we joked about how the two people who do the LEA podcast aren't even in law enforcement anymore. The reason why I was attracted to this job was because I wanted to develop more on my technical skills. So like you learn about CRISA reports, you learn about SQL, you learn about coding, but when you don't do it every day, you don't retain it as well. And that's where I felt like I was lacking. So it was a personal choice of like, oh, this new job, it's a data analyst job. And they do a lot of those things. Like I was saying earlier, like SPSS, which I did not realize was a thing outside of academia, but oh, I'm glad I learned it a little. So I wanted to develop more on those skills. As of this recording, I've been in the job for a little over a month now, so it hasn't been that long. I'm very fortunate that the job even opened and they didn't cancel it halfway because unfortunately, a lot of jobs just they post and then halfway through, they're like, we actually can't have this position. So they cut it, which really sucks. The reason why I brought that up is because I was going through the process while we were producing Sean Bear's guide to hiring a law enforcement analyst, which just plugs everywhere for everything, which you guys can find on our website at leapodcast.com. It's at the top. It says hiring guide right there. And the reason I wanted to bring it up because I literally have firsthand experience of listening to it while reviewing it and stuff and using those lessons to apply it to my own personal hiring process, and it worked. I'm hired. So I'm like, hey, I'm a happy customer came out of it. Yeah. There was one that I really liked was the sending an email, like a thank you email to the hiring people, because I always did it because I thought it was courteous, like just polite. I remember, actually, it was so funny. When I did it for Lakewood, I actually apologized to them because I thought I was the trash in the interview. I was like, I'm sorry I wasted your time with my terrible interview skills and all this other stuff. Like, sorry, you won't get that 45 minutes of your life back.
Oh, my.
I know.
I still hired you, though.
They hired me. So I was like, okay, maybe I wasn't as bad as I thought I was. Like, it's just one of those things where it's like, you're really hard on yourself. Like following this interview, I probably will reach out to you and be like, oh man, that was
really bad. I'm so sorry. It's just one of those things where you're really critical of yourself. But I think what it does is like it established like a relationship. Like you're not just another person. Like you're not just another number or resume on their desk. I mean, we all know like don't put all your eggs in one basket. Like when I did my job hunting, I threw my resume across the country. Like it's not a fact that I hide, but I treat everyone like it was the job of my dreams. And like I always reached out and I always try to establish a rapport because you never know. And I think that was really beneficial. Like I don't know if it was like a vindicated feeling, but it was nice to feel validated after I heard Sean say it, like you should do this. And it's just a reminder, like there's a human being on the other side, you know, like there's someone reading your resume, reading your application. Like you don't want to just treat it like something that you just did, you kind of thing, you know, you want to treat it as important. So that was one thing I really liked about the series, among other things.
Well, good luck in this new position. I'm sure you'll do great. So I want to move on to a couple of different topics before we end the show. I was thinking what to ask you about IAECA elections, and I don't really have a question. I will always say that your work with the IAECA Elections Committee is very impressive. And I know that there were several times at the IAECA conference where you were the only one on the committee that was at the conference. The other members, for various reasons, couldn't attend the conference. So you were the sole person taking on all responsibility for the election process, making sure that the meet the candidates got set up correctly, answering any questions, trying to remedy any of the confusion about the election process. And so I just wanted to say thank you for all the work that you do with the IAECA Election Committee. And I know you'll think it's not that big a deal, but I'm telling you that it is a big deal.
Thanks.
And then I wanted to ask you, in terms of training, what training would you recommend to other analysts? And it can be either analysts that are just starting, folks that are looking to get into the field, or it could be veterans. What training would you recommend to folks?
I really like the IAECA's tactical analysis training. I think it's a week-long course that I went to. I don't know if they have a webinar version now with the pandemic era that we live in, but that class, Jessica LeBlanc was my instructor at the time, and she did a really good job laying out the foundations of what is crime analysis, like again, like the crime analysis 101 kind of setup, but she was also really down to earth and really gave us practical things that we can use. One of the things that she taught that stuck with me that I use now was that how to organize your day of week. So I always started my week Sunday through Saturday. Like that's just how I see weeks and calendars. One thing that she taught us was to group your weekdays. So Monday through Friday, or, you know, Monday through Friday, Monday, Thursday, and your weekends. So Saturday, Sunday, or Friday to Sunday, however you see it, separately. So then you can see patterns easier that way. And it was just like such a simple switch, but it really helped. It's like, oh yeah, I can see the movement. It's crime picked up on the weekend or crime picked up on Monday or something like that. It was a really good practical class that I really enjoyed, and I learned a lot out of it. So whether you're new or you're a veteran, I really recommend that class with the IAECA. Other courses that I recommend would be, whether you want to go into management or not, I think leadership classes are beneficial because it just helps you develop your critical thinking developmentally. I think a lot of times we as analysts focus a lot on technical skills, which we should. You know, if you want to go to an ArcGIS class, go for it. If you want to go to a cell phone analysis class, like go for it. Like definitely, I'm not discouraging those, but I think it's equally important that we train how we see things as well and how we approach things, because being an analyst is not only doing the analytical work. It's also, as we said before, communication, networking, team building. And I think the leadership classes that I went to really helped me develop those and see things in a different light. I Everybody has a different personality. Everybody approaches conflict resolution differently. So I recommend Civilian Leadership Development for the Non-Sworn Public Employee by the Center for American and International Law. I believe they're out in Texas. And then I did another civilian leadership class with the Cristando House Incorporated. I think they're based out in California. When I went to my crime analysis certificate program, they didn't teach me conflict resolution. They didn't teach me effective communication. So I really thought those classes were really good with helping me be more mentally and emotionally more resilient and be able to connect with my team better, connect with my detectives better, connect with my command staff, understand why people are doing things a certain way, why people respond a certain way. Because I feel like it's so easy to just write off anybody who disagrees with you as like, they're just being crazy. They don't know any better. Like, okay, boomer, you know, like one of those things. But like, you know, just write people off so easily who disagree with you. But I feel like those classes really opened my eyes of like negotiation, understanding where people are coming from, empathy, like things that you think would be, again, common sense, but they're not, you know? So I really think it's important to, again, develop not only your technical skills, but also your, I don't know how to phrase it, mental skills.
Yeah, agreed. I also want to ask you about the auto theft associations that you were a part of. You were part of the Auto Theft Prevention Authority Analysts Working Group, as well as the International Association of Auto Theft Investigators. Talk a little bit about those two groups and how they benefited you.
Yeah, so the local chapter is CADI, the Colorado Auto Theft Investigators, and then the IATI, which is the international version of it. It's similar to having a local, like CCAA, the Colorado Crime Analysis Association, and then IACA. So it's similar to that, except it's specific to auto theft. And then the APAL working group was an analyst group of analysts. We met monthly, intel share, and worked on projects together. Those were very beneficial, not only because they were niche to what I was doing at the time, so like auto theft, so I learned things specific, but it was also a more affordable way to get training. So CADI, they do an annual conference as well here in Colorado, and they usually have an analyst track. And again, while it's specific to auto theft because of our association, I felt like those skills were transferable to other specialties. There was one thing that my colleagues and I shared before when we were looking for jobs and, you know, discussing the future and all this stuff is, were we pigeonholed? Were we so niche into auto theft that we cannot, you know, go back to the regular world, for lack of better words? Like we can't find any other jobs because we were siloed into auto theft. And I was like, no, like everything that we learned can be transferred to other specialties. So I learned how to use an access database to score auto theft cases, but what's stopping me from doing it for burglary cases or a murder investigation or something like that? You know, same with what we learned for Excel. So I really like the little lesser known groups because it does offer more affordable alternative training. Not to say that IACA isn't affordable, it really is, but just in addition, like there's benefit by having more training. And I think I shared with you that I was also, I also signed up for Erin Wickersham's, she's a prosecution analyst. I signed up for her prosecution analyst group as well, even though I'm not a prosecution analyst, but I do work with the prosecutor at the very end when we bring our case to the grand juries. I was like, I can learn a thing or two from the, you know, these analysts who do this every day. Like they probably have different tools that I never thought of, or they use Excel in a different way that I never thought of. So I thought it was important to have, you know, that connection. And I also joined a gun intelligence group because I was thinking like, well, auto theft, maybe they'll steal a gun or something. And again, it was one of those, like, maybe they just have different tools that I can use for my case, or maybe they just see things differently. So I like joining as many associations as I can that my work allows me.
All right. I guess the last segment that I had to talk about is just the podcast itself. We have a couple of things going on with the podcast. We have a survey getting feedback from our listeners, the do's and don'ts, things that they like and don't like. So we encourage the listeners to fill out that survey. We're also hiring, quote unquote, hiring We got some asking for some more volunteers to help us with social media, with some research. So if you're interested in joining Mindy and I on this podcast adventure, please contact us. Again, it's leapodcast@gmail.com. Is there anything else that you want to add, Mindy, about the podcast? Things that you wish folks would know?
Just thank you, everyone, for supporting us. This is a, I guess, for lack of better words, a passion project that we've been working on. I remember when we first started, we're like, I don't know, maybe we can get 5 episodes in. I don't know. Like, and now we're over 20, we're almost reaching 30, and people have given us great feedback. Just want people to know, when you fill out the survey, which you can find on our website or in the forums, is we do read every single thing. Like, it's not like you fill out the survey and it goes to a black hole. Like, we do look at it. Your feedback really does matter to us, and we thank you for your support.
All right. Well, as you know, the last question to the show is words to the world. So this is where you can promote any idea that you want to. Mindy, what are your words to the world?
My words to the world is for people to give themselves more time to learn and grow. I feel like as people, and especially analysts, I feel like we're really hard on ourselves and we want to just master everything right away. And it's just one of those professions where it's like you're given so much. Like, I want to learn ArcGIS, I want to learn SQL, I want to learn Access, I want to learn this and that. And it's just so much. And people, I feel like, get discouraged when they don't get it the first few times. I just want to let people know, like, you know, sometimes, like, that's what I'm experiencing now with my new job. Like, the learning curve, like, we call it a curve, but it really is like a vertical line. Like, there's so much to learn, and take it one step at a time. Like, give yourself time to grow. Like, you will get there. Like, all the experts that you've heard on our show and known, they all started somewhere, and you're going to get there. So don't be so hard on yourself. Give yourself time.
Very good. As you also know, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
You have so much on me.
I do appreciate you being on, Mindy. Thank you so much, and be safe.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder, and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.